Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love people who love cats and dogs, which is what this show is all about. I'm proud to be broadcasting on the NPR station Peconic Public Broadcasting, where this show originated and has continued for 14 years and over 650 consecutive shows. Podcasts of every episode are on RadioPetLady.com. And for information about my New York Dog and Cat Film Festivals, which travel the country throughout the year, go to catfilmfestival.com and dogfilmfestival.com. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes foods for cats and small dogs in a human food facility with ingredients that are good enough for us to eat. They have always respected the nutritional needs of cats as obligate carnivores and don't make any dry food for cats, putting human-grade proteins in their cans and pouches with a wide assortment of recipes to entice even the most finicky felines and persnickety pooches. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's, a privately owned company founded and run by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado, who has devoted his career to personally creating specialized litters to meet the needs of every sort of cat. Now available at select Target, Walmart, and other major retailers nationwide, you can try their veterinarian-formulated litter for free with a rebate on their website that refunds your first purchase. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival. My guests today are Margie Alonzo, who's the executive director of a very well-known dog training animal behavior consultancy organization called the IAABC. We're going to talk about dominating dogs, dog training, and how that those two things don't go together. Dr. Judy Corman will be here talking about what the Assisi loop is and what the calmer canine version of it is as a way to non-medically help with healing and calmness. And Sue Pettick will be here with her very funny book, Alaskan Catch, which has Newfoundlands as the main characters. Margie, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time out from what I'm sure is a busy schedule, if nothing else, just herding your beagles.
Yes, well, that is kind of a full-time job. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. We've met because of a strange topic or an interesting topic or one that may just disappear into the ether, but I'm very, very excited to meet you. I have a great deal of respect for the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, as for some of the other dog trainer membership organizations. I know sometimes there's arguments amongst these organizations about best practices, but is it fair to say that none of you professional dog trainers and behavior consultants believe that manhandling a dog, showing it who's boss, is ever the way to solve problems, particularly not aggression problems?
I think that's a hard question to unpack. Certainly not all dog training organizations are aligned. There are those on the left and those on the right, and, you know, sanity, like everywhere else, lies somewhere in the middle three-fifths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think the term manhandling is, everybody would agree that manhandling is not a best practice. Not everybody would agree what manhandling is.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
I think that's where the rub lies.
Okay, that's fair. And to those of us that are on the receiving end of dog training, I always worry, as I do when people who've never been to a psychiatrist or any kind of a mental health professional are about to embark on finding one, and the first one they come across or that their Aunt Mary saw or talked to once a long time ago, they see that person. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that with dog training, and it makes me nervous.
Yep.
Because very complicated. I mean, for you, it's sort of like being shrinks. You have to deal with the human and their neuroses and their lack of education and understanding and their high anxiety level, and then you have the dogs, right?
Right, right. And in fact, however, it's actually not that easy sometimes to not be a shrink, which we are not remotely qualified to be.
Right.
Because we do deal a lot with the human aspect of
yes.
this stuff. It's pretty significant. But it's also, you know, part of best practices is to not pretend that we specialize in anything but the animals. And I do want to clarify that at IAADC, we deal with dogs and cats and parrots and horses and
other animals
as well.
Oh, nice.
So beyond, air quote, just dogs.
Right.
But dogs are certainly, you know, I think the primary focus for a lot of trainers.
But very nice to know for those of you listening who are cat people going, please get to something we want to hear about. It's still interesting because training anything, as many of you have heard Amy Sadler with me on the show over all these 14 years, I was her first dog training client, and she was my first official dog trainer back in California. And we both learned a lot together, both separately and together over the years. And she always contended, and really interesting studies about learning are that everything learns the same way, you know, sort of basically positive reinforcement and that sort of thing, desensitization. These kinds of topics seem to work whether you're an ant or a rat in a maze or a dog or a horse, and there you have it.
Or a person.
Or a person. Thank you. Yes, we no longer humiliate children in classrooms, or we hope it's not being done, and we don't punish them for mistakes. And we hope that that's sort of a general thought about training dogs. How I came to you was to write to Amy and say, you know, I've been asked about this new television show that I did not want to interview the star of it, who was a purported dog trainer, because I asked Nat Geo, who was making the show called Dog Impossible, a dog trainer who only takes on the most aggressive and dangerous dogs, quote unquote. And I thought, this is a prescription for a nightmare. It's going to be like, and, you know, I never said Cesar Millan's name much aloud when I told you all that there was a circus trainer on television who was doing fantastical things with dogs to make them bite him. And there was nothing about it that was something you should take as dog training. It was basically kind of scary entertainment for those who misunderstood it. So I was afraid this new show would be the same. I asked for a screener, so I looked at them, and within minutes I saw this guy was holding dogs up by the neck and choking them and throwing them to the ground and just behaviors that were reminiscent of something medieval. So it turns out you had written, and I'm going to put a link to it with the podcast of the show, what I thought was an absolutely brilliant description of why those techniques were not something that you or your organization stood behind. Can we talk a little bit about how things people see on television of that nature are putting us back in time, turning back the clock in not a good way?
We can. I mean, I wish I shared your opinion that things had moved so far ahead. I don't think they have. I think kids are still humiliated and punished every day in school. And I think that most people, or a lot of people, scoff at dog training that that really takes on a studied and informed educational stance rather than, come on, you know, we've all had dogs for 30,000 years or 20,000
right.
years, you know, choose your scientist. And you know, you didn't have to do any of this crap before, so, you know, why not do it now?
You mean when we lived in the cave, we didn't have to worry about a sit-stay?
Exactly. Although I got news for you. Behavior is not opinion. And so if a behavior repeats, it's being reinforced.
Right.
And so, you know, my guess is those dogs that we didn't train also got bones or meat or scraps or whatever it was when they did certain things or got, you know, scared beaten back when they didn't.
So in this case, there's a television show which may be not even airing anymore by the time our conversation airs. But what it celebrates is this idea of people dominating dogs. And I think what I'd love to discuss with you, because you are a thought leader in this world of dog understanding as well as dog training, dog behavior understanding, why do humans so quickly embrace the idea, yes, I have to be the pack leader, I have to be in charge, I have to show them who's boss, which is not very useful in most situations. And with dogs with aggressive tendencies that come from wherever they come from, fear and past things or not past things, their wiring, it can be really dangerous. how do we dispel this idea about the pack leader thing? How do we wise people up about that?
We're not really in a fact loving time in our history right now.
Oh boy!
But but you know, one of the things is that dogs are not pack animals, and people have
Thank
a really
you.
Hard time with that.
Thank you.
Dogs travel in. I like to think of it as dogs are basically middle aged women. They travel in in loose social groups and scavenge.
You know? You mean, are you talking about me at TJ Maxx?
No.
Yes, yes, scavenging at TJ Maxx. It's one of my main activities. Do go on.
But they, you know, they are extremely social animals. Of course they are. And I think bred intentionally and unintentionally to be affiliated to humans, I think more than any other species we can think of. I'm sure there are people that could argue with that well, you know, but,
yes.
But for our purposes, you know, and so they're extremely affiliative to us. They are scavengers. That's what they do, and which is why the dog food wars crack me up. It's like, my God, you know, they'd be eating Huggies right now.
Preferably used Huggies. Yeah.
So, but they... I think you asked me two things, and help me understand if that's not correct. I believe you said why are people so
yes.
stuck in the dominant
yes.
hierarchy, and
yes.
why do people have a hard time letting go of it?
Yes.
David L. Meek was a guy that talked about dominance theory in a paper that he has since loudly and often said this is incorrect. I stated this poorly. This is not what I meant. Please, everybody, let go of the damn thing. And nobody can.
I'll be darned.
So, but the concept was that there's the alpha male and the alpha female, and they rule like Simba and Nala,
yes.
you know,
yes.
in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has to do what they say. And you know, if you mess with them, they will mess you up.
Yes.
And so on, and so on. I just ducked a stuffed Kong, so I wanted to suddenly go quiet. The dog kills me.
The dog's trying that hard. The beagle is trying that hard to get the contents of the Kong out that it flew
yeah,
towards
really him. Yeah, I really stuffed it in there, so we should have some peace. We should probably speak faster. There's plenty to read and be informed about in what was wrong about that study and what was right about it and the interpretation that people then made. But in fact, there may be a male and a female, but they don't, the alpha, but they don't eat first. And, you know, there may be during times of famine, but you know, there's a social structure. I
mm-hmm.
mean, it's sort of like saying mom and dad are alpha in a family. Well, maybe, but two alpha becomes, you know, actionable, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know,
and also when the children become adolescents, there's pushback, and how do you deal with pushback? If you just ground them, take away their cell phone, they're just going to go out the window. So, right? I mean,
yeah.
you have to pick your battles.
And for the same reason, I think less understandable, the incredible illogic of, you know, if I scruff a dog, it's like being the mother dog, or it's like, this is, I mean, if this wasn't a family show, I'd tell you what that was. but I mean, it's nonsensical. I mean, it's ridiculous, is what it is.
Let me just explain to people when you say scruff. So we all know that mama cats and dogs will pick up their puppies by the loose skin at the back of their neck when they're teensy tiny to move them, probably for safety, from one place to another. Whereas on these TV shows, these trainers are flipping dogs on their back and holding them down by the throat and saying, oh, this is natural. Other animals would
right.
be doing this in the most threatening, the most life-threatening pose that no right-minded animal would do to another or submit to. So do go on.
Right, right. And it's a great way to elicit good TV if you like violence.
Exactly.
And so I think that a lot of the misconceptions have to do with our desire and belief, misplaced as well as sometimes understandable, that if we just, you know, take control, we'll be able to fix this thing we're anxious about, this animal we love, with
right.
you know, whatever it is. I mean, I don't think that the motivation is necessarily evil. What I think is really evil is people who really love their pets and are asking for help, being given this kind of information.
Agreed.
Significantly damages the human-animal bond, as
yep.
well as the animal, often.
Yep.
You know, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, well, it's so bad, why did it work? I mean, I guess we have to define work, but you can absolutely affect change in an animal through all sorts of means, human mm-hmm. or otherwise, right?
Yes.
So you can punish something, you can reinforce something, and if you are not familiar with the quadrants, which are a miserably limited way of thinking about learning, but it's a good starting place. You know, negative and positive reinforcement, negative and positive punishment are to be looked into, and the negative and the positive mean adding something to or taking away, not good and bad.
Right.
You know, all of those work. It's learning. I mean, it's like gravity works. You know, you can argue, but drop a brick over your foot and tell me how gravity is the theory. but I think that the first thing is people want to get help for themselves and their animal.
Yes.
They don't want to be embarrassed.
Correct.
Around their friends.
Yes.
They don't want their kids to get bitten.
Yep.
They don't want, you know. So I think that the shaming people for doing things aspect of this, which I think is pretty prevalent too, isn't appropriate.
Well
and
said.
It's certainly not helpful. And it is also doing to people what we're saying not to do to dogs.
Well said.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, so
yep.
maybe not the best way. And so I think that the first reason is that people want help. People want it to work. And people and it makes sense to us, right? Because
yes.
we are, after all, in charge of the planet.
Yes.
And so if it's, well, let the dog sit where it wants, if it's going to stop barking, you know, somebody might say if they had a beagle, for instance, you know, it's like that's hard for people to swallow. And it's also not always appropriate, right? I mean, certainly one has to be able to have control of one's animal just as one does with a kid. But I don't think it's, you know, if my kid, you know, stood on a table, I cannot see almost any of us slamming the kid to the table, hand on the throat,
right.
on his back, saying, don't ever do this again,
right.
you know, right in his face.
Yeah.
You would be considered insane. It would be actionable. It would be, you know, there's everything wrong with it, but we have trouble extrapolating to that same relational impact when it comes to animals.
You've said it. You've said it really well. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of time, which I wish we had five times more time, and I hope you'll come back to discuss other aspects of training. But the takeaway is, if you see an animal being manhandled, whatever that means to you, pushed around, choked, frightened, scared, beaten down, not with a stick, not even with a hand, but beaten down mentally, you're looking at animal abuse. So if you keep your television turned on or buy that book or whatever it is, you're sanctioning it. You're using your time and your money to say, yeah, I'm down with this.
I would say look for positive reinforcement-based training. Here's what we want us to do, not what we want us to not do.
Nice.
Look for positive
yep.
reinforcement-based training, IAABC, ATDT, CCPDT.
See, I told you there's lots of groups. I'll give links to all of them, but I'm going to go with the IAABC, which is Margie Alonso's group. And thank you so much for being here. I hope you guys have had some takeaway from this, that you understand that we really are not the dominators of the planet or the animals who share our life, but we can certainly teach them lots of good behavior that makes them better companions from our point of view. Thank you so much for being here, Margie.
Thank you.
I'll be right back. This show is brought to you in part by Merrick Pet Food, which has been making natural, nutritious pet food for 30 years. Today, their culinary team continues the family tradition of offering many recipes to choose from, with varieties crafted with healthy grains to their grain-free varieties. Merrick's foods include real whole ingredients bought directly from farmers and partners they know and trust. They never use preservatives, fillers, or anything artificial. Recipes always start with proteins, USDA certified meats, and fresh caught fish as the first ingredient, along with actual fresh fruits and vegetables like whole apples, potatoes, baby carrots, and blueberries. This show is also supported by Daily Dose, a daily dental chew with an outer layer that cleans dogs' teeth, using a patented ingredient that breaks down the biofilm and harmful bacteria that can accumulate on teeth and gums. As well as removing the biofilm, there are biopolymer fibers in these vet-formulated dental chews that actually scrub the dog's teeth. The bonus is that these sustainably sourced chews have dual benefits for various needs. The core of each chew contains clinically proven supplements to help manage your dog's joints, heart, skin, or anxieties. Just one daily dose chew a day cleans your dog's teeth and breath while providing important supplements to soothe, strengthen, or calm. I am delighted to welcome Dr. Judy Corman to the show. I have been fascinated with the Assisi Loop, which is such an interesting name for a canine product, for years and years and years. And now along comes a version of it called Calmer Canine. And this is a loop that you kind of place above your dog's head or skull, and it has calming effects. And I thought, really? And then I find out that Judy Corman, who not only was a very impressive graduate of the University of Pennsylvania Vet School, but then went next door, I went to Penn myself, but undergraduate, to Wharton and got herself a business degree. And she's been working her whole career with time off to do agility training, raise a family, have a mobile home, visit a vet practice in the Carolinas, in being a consultant to vet companies, to pet companies around products and new ideas. So Judy, welcome to the show and congratulations on having such a rich background in knowledge and training and degrees and putting it to such good use. I imagine you're one of those vets who feels very satisfied with how they've put their degrees to use.
Yes, thank you, Tracy. It's great to be here. And it does feel great when you can combine the different aspects of your life, and business and veterinary medicine are, you know, both very interesting in their own right. But the combination is fascinating to me, and I've been able to do so my whole career, in a sense, you know, starting out after business school, working for a consulting firm in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology area, which also had some veterinary animal health customers, as well as then going into the mobile practice, which, of course, needed some business skills, but heavily relied on my veterinary training. And what a great experience that was, being able to go into folks' homes and treat their animals in the comfort of their homes and in the comfort of my mobile clinic, which came right to their door.
Pretty nice. And I'm sure the people whose lives you've touched have been lucky too. What appeals to me is the idea that you didn't just do the business end with a huge amount of medical knowledge. You did both. So you kind of have you have your finger on the pulse of what a pet owner, what their concerns are, what their needs are, what the challenges are of keeping their pets healthy and comfortable and high functioning. Arthritis and joint problems being something that's always concerned me. I don't think most owners are aware of the things they can do to mitigate the natural arthritis and joint problems that happen as a pet ages, how to prevent some of it, but also how to manage it without just pain drugs or oral anti-inflammatories, which is why the Assisi Loop had always, I found it very curious. And I will say that I was so lucky being in the position that I sit in, whatever I'm called, a thought leader, which is rather hilarious to me. I don't know why. It just sounds so funny. Sounds like you should have a little special chair or something to be the thought leader. And the company did send me an Assisi Loop when Maisie was recovering from her ACL surgery. And I thought, well, this is surely helping, but I wasn't sure. So I never really understood the technology. And now there's another iteration called the Calmer Canine, which is a loop that helps with anxiety. So can you explain the Assisi Loop first, because you're both a biotechnology expert and a vet expert. So explain what the loop is first, please.
Sure, absolutely. And I'm so glad that your family member was able to be helped with the loop, because many are with arthritis and other inflammatory conditions. So in a very sort of simple way of thinking about it, the Assisi Loop is a targeted PEMF device. And what PEMF stands for is Pulsed Electromagnetic Field Technology. One of the things that most of us don't know is that the Earth actually has electromagnetic force on it and in it. And when we live on the Earth, we're exposed to that low-level electromagnetic force. And I always found this fascinating, but it sort of helps with the story. When astronauts go up into space, they lose that gravitational electromagnetic force. And NASA, way back when they were, you know, having people go up to the moon, were explaining and exploring that the astronauts were having some medical issues when they came back to the Earth. And lo and behold, they investigated it and found that it is the loss of that electromagnetic field that was leading to the astronauts getting headaches. They got osteoporosis.
No kidding.
So, and it underscores what the importance of these fields are in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
So what the loop is a circular antenna. That's the black part. That's the circle or a coil. And it's attached to a little generator.
Mm-hmm.
That's the little white part on the bottom. And so the generator has batteries in it. And when you turn it on, it generates that pulsed electromagnetic signal, basically a little microcurrent, that then emits this treatment field. And the treatment field is the thing that the body absorbs. And what happens in the body is a biochemical positive reactions as a result of that energy, you know, hitting the body in the way it does. And the reaction that happens is the field increases nitric oxide production. Nitric oxide is a molecule in the body that's involved in inflammation. And so when that is increased, when nitric oxide increases, the body then reduces the inflammation. These things called mediators, which, long explanation, they're sort of the good and the bad guys. They're positive mediators that control inflammation. Those get elevated when nitric oxide is elevated in the body by the loop's activity. But the bad mediators, the ones that cause inflammation, also get lowered as a result of nitric oxide being around. So a short way of saying it is that this energy from the loop and the signal from the loop reaches the body, has a biochemical reaction, which reduces inflammation. The other great thing we've explored recently and has been shown in a clinical study at Animal Medical Center is that the loop also increases the natural opioid levels that are in the body.
Wow.
And so that helps the healing. And we did, Animal Medical Center did a study, Animal Medical Center, on the loop on dogs with this disease. And this is a study we supported just by giving the loops. We had no other support
right.
for the study.
Right.
So it was completely independent. And what they found is that the owners of the dogs who had the active loops, this was a placebo-controlled double-blind study, the owners of the dogs with the active loops used 50% less opioids to control the pain of their dogs than those that had the inactive loops with the stem. So it's opioid-sparing. We knew this from human medicine using the loop-like technology. There's lots of studies documenting that for people, and people can express their pain levels, but dogs can't. So, you know, in the days now where opioids are really under scrutiny and veterinarians are having such a difficult time getting opioids appropriately for their patients, it's really nice to know that the loop has this opioid-sparing effect.
Well, this is really amazing. I didn't know about this study. I knew nothing about it, and I try to stay abreast of things. Animal Medical Center, those of you who have been listening for years know it's the only nonprofit veterinary teaching hospital in the country. It happens to be in our very own New York City and has some of the great minds in the field. The fact that they did a double-blind placebo-controlled study, which is very costly, if you, and I'm sure, Dr. Corman, you could okay this idea, there, if you want to do that at some of the big universities, companies that want to do a trial on CBD or almost anything, they pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to the university to run it. Not thousands,
absolutely,
but hundreds of thousands. It's very, very costly. And most of the studies that you read a little bit about were not done as double-blind placebo-controlled. So they took 8 old Labradors that were limping around and gave them whatever the thing was, and they limped a little less. But that's not really a controlled study. And I always thought that that non-invasive, holistic type of treatments were never going to get studied in that highly rigorous scientific way because it costs too much and there's not enough profit to be made the way there is, let's say, in pharmaceuticals where there's all that money floating around. So that's a pretty impressive result. Now, knowing that, does the Animal Medical Center recommend, and I'd love to talk to some of the doctors there about it. I'm sure you'll, I don't know, Rob Hart, the orthopedist, has been on the show many times, but I'm wondering if, do they recommend it to patients to get one of their own? Because I have a dog with disc problems, and I didn't know this about the disc problem. She has one bulging disc and one blown disc. She covers up her pain all the time. Nothing to do with the ACL surgery, although maybe it contributed. I'm going to get the loop out and start using her. I didn't know that there was something I could be doing to help minimize the inflammation, which is endemic with having disc problems. So are people being encouraged, patients in those situations, to get a loop?
Absolutely. And the information that Animal Medical Center received in their study and have published on it has also been duplicated in another study at North Carolina State University with a neurologist, Dr. Olby. And that was a second study on very severe disc disease dogs, dogs who had undergone surgery for their disc disease. And they found not only an improvement in wound healing, but also a faster return to proprioception, which is the ability
right.
to feel your
mm-hmm.
limbs.
Mm-hmm.
in the dogs that had the loop. And so I'll send you both those studies for sure so you can see all that information. But these are both double-blind placebo-controlled studies. And that is one of the best indications of the loop. Of course, arthritis and chronic conditions as well. But dogs with disc disease seem to really benefit from loop therapy.
Wow. And healing. Now, how does it work different than the cold laser therapy that you have to make an appointment with your vet, go to the vet, the dog wears goggles, you wear dog goggles. I mean, it's a thing that involves an entire interchange of the vet rather than something that you simply press a button and it sits quietly on the dog and you sit next to the dog or nearby and it works for the whatever it is, 10, 15 minutes that it's on. Is laser therapy work in a completely different way than this electromagnetic field?
Yes, it does. It's laser therapy is a different type of energy application, so
okay.
It's called photobiomodulation. The two do have something in common, though, so I'm glad you brought that up. They both increase nitric oxide levels in the body. So in that way, they're similar. But you're right about the laser therapy. It can be very inconvenient for folks because you do have to go to the vet. The dog has to wear goggles.
You have to wear them too, yeah.
You have to wear goggles, yes. And it doesn't work through casts and through sometimes thick fur, so they might have to shave.
Oh.
It can be difficult with animals that have dark skin. You know, so there are cautions with it, and it doesn't work through casts and bandages, whereas the loop does. You can just put it on top of the cast, on top of the bandage, under a bed for bedding, and it will have its application. So it is a little bit more user-friendly and much easier to take home. Most vets will not let their lasers go out the door.
No.
They're very expensive.
Yeah, yeah, and you don't want to really try
them right.
And you don't want to fool with that at home. It has settings. It has all kinds of things that make you, you know, it would not be what it's not really meant for the end user to take home. Talk, if you would, about the Calmer Canine Loop, which is the thing that you've been most involved, I think, with developing. And I think you told me before we spoke, you even have your name on the patent. It's a loop that looks like the Assisi loop, that I call it more of a healing loop. The Calmer Canine, in the picture I saw, this loop sits like a little halo on the dog's head. It just sort of sits there. And what does it do?
Yes. Okay. So the Calmer Canine is based off of the same technology as the Assisi loop, which you know we're very happy about because that technology is a great platform for developing easy-to-use applications for different conditions in animals. But we worked with a team of neurobiologists and scientists and engineers to tune the signal, to change the loop signal so that it would have a greater application and greater efficacy to treat anxiety in dogs. So anxiety in dogs is created by inflammation in the brain, in the center of the brain that controls emotions, which is called the amygdala. And this center of the brain in a dog that has anxiety, and we studied it in separation anxiety, is a brain that's out of balance. It's got way too much inflammation and those pro-inflammatory cytokines and molecules, and not enough of the anti-inflammatory. So there's this sort of war going on in that brain. What calmer canine does, it's a different signal than the ACC loop, but it does effectively reduce that brain inflammation so that the animals can be less anxious and be more calm. So in our pilot study that we did to explore the effects in dogs with separation anxiety, we found that after 28 days of twice-a-day usage, 15-minute each session, just similar to the loop in that 15-minute treatment twice a day, the owners were holding it over the dog's head in a certain position that we had requested. And 100% of the dogs met the endpoint of the study after the 28 days, which was a reduction, a noticeable reduction in their anxiety. And we picked separation anxiety because it's an easily studied anxiety. We can take videotapes of the dogs when the owners leave, which we did in the study, and see how the dogs behave. And we found in the videotapes that not only did the owners notice there was a benefit in the owner questionnaires, but we also found on videotape analysis of the dogs and the different behaviors they showed us that there was a benefit on the videotape as well. So, you know, dogs don't lie. They showed the benefit, and we were so excited for those dogs. One of the dogs was a dog named Granite, and pit bulls have a bad problem with separation anxiety, and this dog was a pit bull, and his owner had adopted him about a year before, and he showed terrible signs. He was rated by his owner as most severe, grade 3. And what he would do, unfortunately, he'd be crated because he would destroy the house and himself. If not, he would bite at the crate door, and there was a little bloody drool. Every yep. time she left him alone, she would come home and find this. And she was so upset. She didn't know what to do. So she put him on the calmer canine in the study. And after the 4 weeks, actually, he was getting better at week 3, she came home, and there was no more bloody drool. And he went from a 3 to a 0. In her rating scale, which was phenomenal. And we saw the results on the video analysis. The dog would very have a very bad problem with biting at the crate door in the beginning, and very anxious, very pacing in his crate, not resting. And after 4 weeks of therapy, he was not biting at the crate door. He was resting, playing with his toy, Kong, in his crate. And so she was able to, we checked back a year later, she was able to take a job outside the house, whereas before she wasn't even able to go to the grocery store without, you know, fearing that she would be leaving him in such a state. So that was a big success story. We were so happy.
Was he able to come out of the crate? Did he get to have a life like a normal dog and not be crated whenever she left?
Yes. She reported to us that they had structured an area of the house that was much larger than the crate, and that was a benefit,
nice.
Too, that he not only, you know, was able to be a little calmer, but he also could get a little bit more real estate in his life.
Nice. Well, that's obviously a really dramatic example, but many people have dogs with various anxieties that worry them. I mean, I had a friend that didn't want to leave the house, and I said, leave the dog in the mudroom and leave it with a, you know, a rawhide or something. But she worried the whole time. And the dog didn't, and the dog did destroy lots of things in the house when she was allowed loose in the house. She was a rescue actually from Southampton shelter, who'd been moved from a Vermont shelter to Southampton shelter. And then I helped bring her back up to Massachusetts for my friend. And the dog was fine as long as the person was around. But there wasn't a calmer canine then. And, you know, people talk about medicating these dogs with psych drugs, and I think that would be frowned upon by anybody kind of forward thinking. You don't want to give your dogs antipsychotic or, you know, mental drugs. You want to make them more comfortable in their own skin, not just dumb them down.
Absolutely.
So yes, is this something that...
she was so happy this could be a drug-free solution.
Yeah. Definitely. Is this something that that once the dog's brain has been rebalanced, if you want to call it that, recalibrated,
right,
that it doesn't need the calmer canine anymore, or you give it less frequent treatments?
That's a great question, and we do get that question a bit. And it's basically what we found from the pilot study, that we treated the dogs for 6 weeks in the pilot study and then stopped treatment and looked at them 2 weeks after. They had had no treatment in those 2 weeks. And we found that two-thirds of the dogs had maintained the benefit that they had gotten in the 6 weeks of treatment, or even improved a little more after the treatment was stopped. But a third of the dogs would have needed to continue on the treatment. So it is a mixed bag, but that's natural because, you know, dogs have been through so many different experiences.
Correct.
And it depends on how long they've had the separation anxiety or anxiety going on and how that brain has evolved. But I would say that we were quite impressed. And in the case of Granite, you know, we checked back because she was a pilot study participant. We had to take the devices back after the pilot study. So Granite hadn't been treated for the whole year after he was treated for the 6 weeks, and he continued to do quite well. But, you know, we do understand that that condition can have relapses from time to time if the environment changes, maybe a death in the family, unfortunately, or a big switch in moving to a new house, for example. That can basically bring back an anxious dog.
Right, because an anxious dog is an anxious dog. What you're doing is helping make that dog more balanced, which is a word that's often used by trainers about dogs. We have run out of time. I would love to talk about the Harvard study that you mentioned to me before we got on the air and studying humans and parts of their brains. We will have to continue this conversation at another time, Dr. Judy, because it really is fascinating and so fantastic that technology, this kind of cutting-edge technology, is available and can make life better for the pets. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
Terrific.
On your involvement.
Thank you, Tracy.
Take care. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks for being here. This show is brought to you in part by Zymox Orotine Dental Products, Oral Gels and Sprays, which can help you keep your dog's teeth clean easily with or without brushing. Zymox also makes dermatology products for dogs and cats, topical cream and spray for skin conditions using a patented LP3 enzyme system, which works to prevent or reduce inflammation and to gently heal skin irritations and itchiness. And for dogs with chronic ear problems, Zymox Ear Cleaning Solution has helped many dogs get off antibiotics. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, freshly made dog food shipped to your door. Evermore is owned by two women who are so serious about human-grade ingredients that they actually ate Evermore Pet Food themselves for a whole month. Hannah and Allison make their food by conscientiously selecting fresh organic vegetables mixed with fresh, humanely raised beef, lamb, chicken, or turkey to make nutritionally balanced dog food. After low-temperature cooking, the sealed pouches are frozen and shipped right to your home to be served as a complete meal or as part of your pet's diet. We're also supported by Iceland Pure, a privately owned company that guarantees freshness and purity in their human-grade omega-3 fish oils for pets, odor-free salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils, responsibly sourced in the clean waters of Iceland and Norway. Now they have added Next Level Premier Fish Oil, which contains shark oil for the first time. Sold only in independent pet stores or with a 10% discount directly from the company, the health benefits of shark oil have been documented. For more information about the research about the healing powers of shark oil, please go to RadioPetLady.com or Iceland Pure's website. I am here with Sue Pethick, who, boy, if Newfoundlands didn't have a champion before, they sure do now. Alaskan Ketch. What a wonderful novel, Sue, and what a great main dog character, Bear, the 150-pound Newfie. What a guy.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I'll tell you, I fell in love with the breed in just doing the research for this book. It was so much fun. And the funny thing is I've actually had a chance to see in person two Newfoundlands fairly recently, and they are big and they are sweet, and you just want to hug them when you see them.
And they're very hairy. I was going to ask you, my goddaughter out in California, between she and her parents, they have seven Newfoundlands in Southern California, seven.
Ooh.
They say
wow.
They're like potato chips. You can't just have one. I don't know if that's true because, boy, their houses are full of a lot of loose fur. But I was wondering if you you decided to you wanted a Newfoundland in your novel and then did the research, which you've just answered the question, or whether you were already in love with them and tried to build a book around them. So it was the first. You
yes,
knew you
really
wanted
was.
A Newfie. So how did you, well, Alaska in itself is such a wonderful setting for the book.
Yeah.
Are you an Alaskan lover of Alaska, knowledgeable about Alaska, or are you just, again, immersed yourself and give the impression of knowing everything there is to know?
Well, thank you. I'm glad you got that impression.
I did.
I actually pretty much fell in love with it by doing the research. But the idea of it was something my agent had an assistant last summer, and she was actually from Kodiak, Alaska, and she said, "Gosh, you know, there's not much written about, you know, my area," and she said, "You know, would you ever consider doing that?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'll look into it." Now, I ended up not using Kodiak. It's a not that I have anything against it, but it was a little bit smaller town, and I needed more things that could happen, you know.
Right.
So I started looking around, and I looked at Ketchikan, and I was just absolutely so impressed with that town. They have, just an awful lot. It's kind of an artist colony in a lot of ways. You know, people, you know, I'm originally from San Diego, California, and then I'm now in Vancouver, Washington. And Alaska is kind of this, I really didn't know much of anything about it except that people fish up there and it's cold, you know.
Right, it's an exotic place. And
it really is.
A vet who goes around to these small enclaves, you want to talk about small towns, gatherings mm-hmm. of people living off the grid, 40 or 50 people. And
yep.
I think to most of us, it's such an exotic place and such a amazing place to set a book, but what a job you did. So you really did reverse engineer it. First, it was like, how about Alaska? And then like, how about a Newfoundland? And you give the impression, I thought, well, I guess Sue at some earlier point in her life worked in a canning factory. So that's a big compliment to you.
Well,
you picked the fishing industry and you picked canning. And I'm like, this is so interesting. None of us really stop and think, where is all that fish caught and brought in and
mm-hmm.
processed? And how did you learn about it through YouTube, or did you go stand in a cannery and put on rubber boots for a while? Because you give such a great depiction of it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I do a lot of research, but I actually interviewed two people who had worked in canneries. One of them happens to be my brother-in-law, who did salmon fishing off of the Alaskan coast for many years, many summers. But when he started out, he also worked the slime line and all that. He told me stories about going into the in the freezer and spending hours there, half a day, and just without the proper equipment. The other person was again my agent's assistant, Amanda Block, and she had during summers. She said up there the kids, you know, the teenagers love to work in the at the canneries during the summer. She said it's good pay for a kid.
It's rough. The fish goo and the slime. I mean, the book starts.
Yeah, no,
the book starts, and the slime line, and Bear mm-hmm. with the dog sliding into the slime line and getting everybody in trouble. It's great to find out about. I think one of the things I love about my job is that in having books about cats and dogs cross my path, I mm-hmm. learn about so many other things that have little or nothing to do with the dogs, but have to do mm-hmm. with the world around us. And I wonder if that's true for you, too, because your previous two novels were dog-centric. And so
mm-hmm.
that's clearly something that either is, I mean, by the way, I've never heard of an agent that gives authors ideas and encourages them. So that's a miracle. Do not let that agent go. Let me tell you that. Most of them are like, really? And, you know, you're lucky if they answer your phone or your email.
Well, I have a terrific agent. Thank you.
You most certainly do, Ollie. But the fact that Newfoundlands, because they are such a marvelous breed of dog, and mm-hmm. to find out that you only just recently met two of them, they're really quite extraordinary. I'm sure you know, because you know their history of swimming mm-hmm. and rescuing sailors and having rescued a bunch of famous people. There are competitions held to this day of Newfoundlands dragging in boats and stuff. I mean, it's quite interesting. It's a subculture of the dog world that people with Newfies have competitions and have them practice doing what they historically always did.
Mm-hmm. And they also have you know, carting competition. They pull carts, you know, but yeah, they, no, there are several chapters of Newfie clubs.
Exactly.
And they have all sorts of competitions, like you say. It's really pretty amazing. You know, you talk about learning something when you write, excuse me, when you read a novel. And to me, pardon me, I had to clear my throat. To me, having that's one of the wonderful things about a novel. You know, when I read a novel, I want to learn something. You know, I want to go through the story and you know, see what the characters are doing and you know, live through them for a while. But I also want to learn something, and I think most people who read novels do that. And so the wonderful thing about writing a novel is I get to do that as well. I get to do I love doing the research. And this particular book was an awful lot of fun.
Well, I'm
learning about new fees and things.
It occurs to me that given that you've already, you know, become Alaskanized, if there is such a word, and loving this particular breed of dog, I will, who knows, if you really wanted to follow along in real time, Dr. Ken Hill has this trawler that he's turned into a floating vet clinic, and he visits these various Alaskan ports. And it seems to me, a woman with your imagination and curiosity, can you imagine the story that you could, it didn't occur to me when interviewing him, but the story you could weave of this trawler and the things that could happen on the boat, to the boat, in the boat, in the ports. So it's great fun.
You started me off on another book.
Yes, you could get your inspiration from almost anywhere. One of your previous books was Boomer's Bucket List. Talk about it briefly, just because people may have heard of it, as I have, and I somehow missed it as an interview for us when it came out. But talk a little bit about that book.
Okay. Boomer's Bucket List was inspired by, it was kind of viral for a while there. I don't know if it's still out there on YouTube. People who had dogs who were given, unfortunately, you know, poor diagnoses. The dogs didn't have a long time to live. And I don't know exactly how that started, but it seemed like all of a sudden on YouTube, there were a lot of people saying, well, you know, I'm taking my dog, we're going to go, you know, and do all these wonderful things in the little time that they have left. And I thought, how interesting, you know, what would you do, you know, and how would that evolve? You know, what kind of things? And of course, in that book, Jennifer is very busy with her life. And in fact, feels very guilty once she finds that her dog does not have long to live, because she has, you know, she gets him at a time in her life when she's trying to make all these changes. You know, she's gone through a divorce and really wants to have, you know, this that raises him as a puppy and stuff, but then kind of gets pulled away from, as we all often
we do.
You
we
know,
do.
We get busy with our lives, we get busy with our work, and unfortunately, sometimes our relationships with our pets kind of suffer. You know, we have great ideas when we first get them. Oh, we're going to do this and
that.
We're going to go places. We're going to, you know. And suddenly she realizes, I'm not going to have all those years with this dog that I thought I would have. And she feels very guilty. And that's what drives her to say, okay, in the little time we have left, we're going to do everything I wanted to do, you know, that we wanted to do together. And so that's what gets her started in this book is, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to make this up to the dog and to myself in the time that we have left?
It's really a wonderful idea. I have a passage that I've picked out for you to read from Alaskan Catch, but maybe you should talk first to sort of set the scene for what it was about the relationship between Emily and the people in the Alaskan Catch world that motivated you to write the book, that inspired you to start on it, and what you would sort of describe as its theme.
Oh, okay. All of my books are basically love stories. And in them, not only the love between the main characters, but the love for the dog and how the dog loves the people, and often can help them see that maybe they belong together, if they, you know, even though they may not realize that. In Alaskan Catch, Emily has really just thought she was there for the summer. she was going to work
right.
on the right. And but her first day on the job in the cannery, this great big dog comes running right in, and she gets knocked over by him. Actually, she kind of helps him. There are a lot of ins and outs there, but as she falls on the floor, there's the dog, and he's licking her. He's feeling very sad about and remorseful about having knocked her down. And his owner, who's a very handsome guy, comes in, tries to help her up, pulls the dog back, and their eyes meet, and then there's just a spark there. They have kind of a rough patch, some disagreements later, but finally
that's
the attraction kind of takes
it. Yeah, that's basically it. They meet in the cannery, and the dog
is
what
brings them
together.
They meet in the cannery, and they keep having kind of, you know, meetings meetings, and but...
Well, let's read this. Let's read this passage.
Okay. All right. Well, he has had to go back to sea. He cannot take his dog with him anymore. So Emily's decided to help out, and she shows up at his house to watch Bear for the day.
Right.
And so we'll start with that. The big dog was watching out the window when Emily arrived, a halo of fog framing his anxious face. When he saw her, Bear gave a series of sharp barks that, to her ears at least, sounded like a rebuke. She was late, he was telling her, and he'd been worried. I know, Emily said as she opened the door. I'm sorry, Bear, you're right. I should have gotten here sooner. All was forgiven, though, as she'd known it would be, and Bear's leaps of joy and sloppy kisses were offered up like champagne on New Year's Eve. Emily lifted the bag in her hand and gave it a shake. I brought you a present, too. Want to see? Emily opened the bag, but before she could retrieve its contents, Bear thrust his entire head inside. Emily had to struggle to wrest it away. Hold on there, buddy. Give me a second. She put her hand into the bag and took out a brush and a comb, holding them out for his inspection. What do you think? She said. Ready to get gorgeous? One of the few advantages of being shunned by her roommates had been the amount of alone time it afforded her, and Emily had been determined not to waste it. Since she would be in charge of Bear at least part of every day, she'd decided to learn as much about the Newfoundland breed as possible, and to call it an education was an understatement. The dog's enormous size, sweet disposition, and love of children were not surprising, but their reputation for rescuing people from the water was a revelation. Stories about tens and even hundreds of people being pulled from shipwrecks by Newfoundland dogs, even those with no training in water retrieval, were fairly common. She could see why Sam had wanted to have his dog along on the boat at work. He and his crew had actually been safer with Bear on board. Among the dog's many wonderful traits, however, was a potential problem that Emily thought she might be able to help with. Newfies, as they were affectionately called, had thick, double coats that insulated their bodies and kept them warm in the harsh winter months. When the weather was warm, though, as it was then, that same double coat quickly became a burden, threatening them with heat-related complications. With summer already underway, Emily figured the Bear might just appreciate having both the weight and the heat of his thick, insulating coat thinned out a little. As the dog sniffed his new grooming implements warily, she grinned. Just think of this as a spa day. It took a while to convince Bear that brush and comb were not, in fact, toys for him to play with, but after a brief game of keep-away and a tug-of-war that left some pretty impressive tooth marks in the brush handle, Bear decided that being groomed while taking a nap was a perfectly acceptable way to spend the afternoon. When Emily had finished brushing out the fur on his left side, he rolled onto his right without even seeming to wake. As the pile of discarded fur grew, Bear's coat became darker and glossier. Emily smiled. She hoped Sam would be pleased.
It's so sweet because you really do depict the dog as having a personality and interaction and intentions, and I guess that's what makes a dog as part of a book delightful for many of us, is if the dog is a full-fledged character too, and his part
in
bringing this couple together and keeping them together and making sure that they can feel the love for each other that he feels for them and vice versa. I think it's really great. Thank you for the wonderful job that you've done. An Alaskan Cat, Sue. It's a delightful book and a great fun for everyone to read. Thank you so much for doing it and for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.